Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up a little later, stay ahead with just some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, Etiquini's infrastructure crisis, it seems, is going from bad to worse. Is Limpopo ready for its Easter traffic and events onslaught? The sugar and wheat tariff changes and the impact on agribusiness, and changes in insurance philosophy in South Africa. It's Thursday, the 17th of April. Now, it's a national problem, but I want to focus on one specific region and mounting challenges in the Etiquini municipality, where residents are grappling with deteriorating infrastructure, water shortage and service delivery failure. And with me now is Zakhele Ndlovu, a political science lecturer at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. I want to look at root causes, potential solutions and also obstacles hindering progress in the region. So, Zakhele, a very warm welcome to you, and maybe the useful jump-off point here is the primary factors contributing to the current state of crisis in Etiquini. What's your assessment? What's your reading of the situation?
Yeah, so let me begin by saying that I think the problem started back in 1994. As soon as the ANC was voted into power, it got the sense that it was a party that the people loved very much. And of course, they have kept it in power up until now. So Etiquini has been controlled by the ANC since 1994. Now, I think that's where the problem starts. The leaders of the ANC who took charge in KZN were not the people who were equipped to govern the city. And then the bigger problem, which is not confined to Etiquini, is that there are no accountability mechanisms. So leaders are not doing the job, and then the people don't hold them accountable when they go to the polls. So that is a much bigger problem, which is not confined to Etiquini. But obviously, here in KZN, the ANC has been doing very well, particularly Etiquini. And the people of Etiquini are paying the price for their loyalty to the ANC.
And I'm imagining at this point, given that the situation is virtually on a cliff edge at the moment, that people are becoming more disaffected, particularly as more and more are denied access to essential services.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I remember back in 2021, after the floodings, there's one specific area that I remember. It's called Tongat, not far from Kinshasa International Airport. That area there, Tongat, it went for more than 6 months without water. Now, I don't know who can survive for so long without access to water. And then as we speak about water, the problem is that, so you have these tankers that come and supply water. And it has been alleged that there's a mafia that runs that particular program. So, and then of course, it's not only water. There's a problem with potholes. Almost every road has got potholes, cars being damaged, tires and so on. So there's a lot of other issues. And of course, the Etiquini Metro Police is not doing its job as well. And lately they have hired the kids who were in the student movement on campuses. They've been deployed into the police force. So I think people are becoming fed up right now with the lack of basic services. And also there are areas where even the conditions are so unsanitary, it compromises the health of even young people.
So Kelly, if the people of the province, as you're suggesting, are paying a heavy price for their loyalty to the ANC, politically then, where does this leave the party going forward?
Well, look, I think the ANC now, with the formation of the MK party, now faces some kind of competition. So, but again, the problem is that many people don't realize that they are unhappiness with the ANC and their new loyalty to the MK party. You know, these are the same political parties. I was just talking to a group of my postgrad students, and I was asking them who they voted for last year. Four of them said they voted for the MK party. And I was saying to them, but you say you are fed up with the ANC, but you are voting for a party that is led by someone who is fighting for his membership to be reinstated in the ANC. So look, the ANC right now has to go back to the drawing board and try to figure out what it needs to do to win back the support first that it lost to the MK party in last year's elections, and just generally to regain the confidence of those people who are no longer voting. Because I think what has happened in South Africa is that those people who are fed up with the ANC are not voting for other political parties, but they decide to stay at home and not vote.
Just a final question. In June last year, two senior government veterans were given the job of turning the fortunes of the eThekwini municipality around. It was Dr. Mike Sutcliffe, the former city manager, along with Cassius Lubisi, who was a former DG in the presidency, the so-called Section 154 intervention. To the best of your knowledge, has that made any progress at all?
Well, looking from the outside, nothing has changed whatsoever. But I'm sure that they would make an argument that if you are privy to certain things, maybe there are some changes that they've introduced. But looking from the outside, you don't see any change. You know, there were heavy rains yesterday, and you drive around the city center, downtown Durban, and there's dams everywhere, you know. The water is not flowing. So to answer your question, Jeremy, look, nothing has really changed. Maybe we need to give them more time to effect some changes, but so far there haven't been any changes.
And residents in the greater metro will argue that they are fed up and that time has run out as far as that particular issue is concerned. Zakheli Ndlovu, thank you very much indeed from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Thank you for joining me today. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's wheat and sugar industries are once again in the spotlight. The National Treasury slashing import duties on wheat and flour, potentially lowering costs for consumers. I guess that's good news. But at the same time, it sharply hiked sugar tariffs twice in just 1 week. And supporters say these moves help balance supply and protect local producers. But critics are arguing the system creates uncertainty and could even distort the market. So let's look at the implications. I'm in conversation with Francois Rousseau, Chief Executive Officer of the Southern African Agri Initiative. Francois, thank you very much indeed. Let's start with the basics. How do you think Treasury justifies sharp tariff shifts without any formal investigation by ITAC, which is the International Trade Administration Commission?
Well, good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to your listeners. Well, you know, for us, I think if we look at the two types of tariffs with regards to wheat and wheat prices, you know, South Africa only produces about half of the wheat that is required by the country and imports the other half. And it's just not profitable for farmers to try and fill that gap, as we have other type of commodities we can perform better in. And also South Africa's climatic conditions is not susceptible into producing that. So for us to lower tariffs on wheat, and that's what we require, and because it is required so much by the consumers themselves, we see that as a good move and a logical move, as this has been the trend for the past 20 years with regards to production.
What will it mean then for farmers who are already battling?
Well, you know, from that side, we are not a very strong producer of wheat just because it is that hard to produce it. Those farmers who do farm wheat, they already are able to push their full quota into the market, and most of them are diversified as well. So it's not something that we compete in very well. And like I said, you know, we are food secure because we can trade that which we have an abundance of for that which we require.
So now let's talk.
In this case, meaning wheat.
Fair enough. So now let's talk about sugar, which I think you've said is a win for local farmers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we all know that with regards to the sugar taxes in previous years and the price going up, you know, it's put a lot of pressure on sugarcane farmers. And it's all about profitability. Any farming enterprise is about profitability. If it's wheat, if it's sugar, if you're not able to produce it and make a profit, then you're not going to farm with that commodity. Now, for us as family farmers and the representatives of family farmers, we welcome and we recognize the fact that, you know, the tariffs have been increased, but that protects our local farmers, and especially in a sector that employs about 85,000 workers that are directly affected in the industry.
I understand your argument and also the constituency that you represent, but let me put to you that this also comes at the expense of millions of South African consumers who will feel the knock-on effect because we are already battling food inflation.
Yeah, no, well, there's no disputing that. And, you know, I think that is something from a consumer vantage point that needs to be challenged. But again, you know, for us representing from a farmer side, this is not a bad thing.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about transparency as far as this policy is concerned regarding sort of picking winners and losers here. So you've spoken about wheat duties. That's going to cause difficulties for farmers. Sugar duties rise. Who decides which sector gets protection and what criteria? It almost, in one way, seems like someone's throwing a dice here.
Yeah, well, Jeremy, I can tell you from a producer side, we are not recognized in that determination. I'm sure there are other agencies and research firms which are hopefully consulted when these types of tariffs are introduced. And hopefully also what we can glean from it is that past adjustments or past amendments have been taken into consideration.
Some critics, Francois, will argue that short-term tariff flips like this create a boom-bust cycle in farming. And surely it's going to affect smaller-scale farmers when it comes to their planning if this policy keeps changing.
Yeah, I think with regards to these two commodities, these are not usually your smaller scale farmers that are affected. And especially with regards to the markets that they serve as well, I do not think that is applicable to such a large extent.
So let's get back to the sugar industry, if we can. Something that you've welcomed, but surely these tariff hikes mask maybe deeper structural issues within the sector itself. I'm talking about things like outdated practices, maybe inefficiency, or even poor labor conditions.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a tough one, and I'm sure it does. But you know, these are the type of deeper issues that need to be investigated, and this is also what will be discovered if there's a bigger consultation with the sector.
There's also concern, Francois, that tariff protection, such as we're talking about now, reduces competitiveness. Do you think that we're making local producers maybe a little more complacent rather than globally competitive?
No, not at all. If there's two countries in the world that do not get subsidies, that do not get disaster relief aid, and especially tariff protection, it's the South African farmers and it's the New Zealand farmers. You can talk about the most parts of Europe, which actually the only reason why they are competitive is because they are protected via tariffs and subsidies. South African farmers definitely do not fall into that category.
But what happens if the tariffs change again, if we get another flip-flop? Surely it creates uncertainty within both of those sectors and maybe even other sectors as well. And again, it comes back to my question about making things more difficult to plan. Do you not need more consistency and even transparency from government in terms of this issue?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the transparency issue. But again, Jeremy, you know, with regards to wheat, we are not able to produce enough even for local demand. We only produce 50% of it. And then with regards to sugar, most of our sugar production goes to the SACU countries, which is Botswana, Eswatini, Namibia. And we need to protect local producers in that sense. But it's also, these are only two of the commodities and not the sector as a whole.
So you've said that wheat imports help, if I've heard you correctly, with a stable supply. But doesn't that also make us maybe too reliant, maybe even dangerously reliant on international markets, particularly during global shocks? Is there any way of right-sizing that equation, do you think?
Yeah, you see, the fact is this goes back since forever, you know, since the 90s and even before that. South Africa has never been a producer of wheat so that we can meet the local demand. So we've always traded that we have an abundance of, and I mean, South Africa is a net exporter of agricultural commodities. So we trade that of which we have a surplus for that we do not. So in that regards, we do not really see an issue. And because the global wheat supply is very stable and there is an abundance of, and that's also the reason why the prices not only stay level and sufficient, but are also at a very good position, is because we have enough countries in the world that are able to supply wheat to countries like ours who require it.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. François Rousseau, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the Southern African Agri Initiative.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move now from farming to tourism. And this Easter weekend, Limpopo is expecting a flood, not of rain, but of people. Over 1.5 million pilgrims are making their way to churches and religious sites across the province, and they'll be joining thousands more attending football matches, marathons and music festivals. The Limpopo Tourism Agency says it's fully geared to receive the crowds, with new infrastructure and awareness campaigns aimed at turning short religious visits into longer-term tourism opportunities. But behind the packed chalets, the roadside activations, important questions do remain. Is Limpopo really ready for this kind of volume? Can the infrastructure and emergency services cope? And the surge of activity, is it truly benefiting local communities, or is it simply just boosting the optics? Joining me now is Moses Ngobeni, Chief Executive Officer of the Limpopo Tourism Agency. Mr. Ngobeni, welcome to you. And let me ask you if the province is overreaching with this Easter tourism push, or can you genuinely handle the volume?
No, thanks very much, Jeremy and the listeners. Yes, as a province, we are ready. We are ready. You know, actually, this is something that we've been waiting for, you know, for a long time. When Easter is approaching, we get ready, we get the industry, because these are the people who are going to receive, you know, our visitors. We get them ready. Just yesterday, the MEC for the Department of Economic Development, Environment and Tourism was opening another lodge, Nels Fleay Lodge, which is also part of the international Ramsar sites, you know, and is part of that accommodation. But above that, we have spoken to all the tourist attractions, you know, the tour operators, the tourist guides. These are the people that make us proud to say, you know, Easter, it's here. Please make sure that we are able to handle as a province. And we are ready, Jeremy.
But logistics are always going to be a challenge. I'm thinking of roads, hospitals, general safety systems. Yes. 1.5 million people over 4 days is a lot. Do you have specific measures in place, for instance, to manage the traffic congestion and emergency response, particularly in those pilgrimage zones?
Yes. With regard to the pilgrimage, you know, on the N1, and also these roads, you know, that come from Vembe, that come from Mopani district, which are all connectors, you know, into Polokwane. The Department of Transport and Community Safety, they are ready. You know, they are combat ready. They've gotten all the traffic officials, you know, to be in those major intersections just to make sure that there is that traffic flow and to ease the congestion. Because obviously you also have people that are coming back home from Gauteng. As a province, we get a lot of our guys, you know, coming back from Gauteng, but also into the destinations. You know, we are not far from Gauteng. thing. That's why a lot of people who just want a weekend away, you know, they choose Limpopo because of that proximity from the market, you know, in Gauteng into Waterberg area, your Bilabila, which is like less than an hour from Pretoria, you are there. And people, they are spoiled for choice. They can choose wherever they want to go.
That's all well and good, but how do you ensure that local businesses, smaller businesses and wider communities benefit not just from a headline event, but financially and sustainably from the surge that you're speaking about?
Yeah, we have prioritized as a province, you know, what we call the event strategy within the MICE. And we are bringing all those traders, you know, people that live out of trading, general trading, you know, selling fruits, especially people that are coming here, they must go back, you know, with the citrus fruits. It's that season now. And they are in abundance in Limpopo. You don't need to go to the Joburg market, you know, to be able to buy those people. So we conscientize them, all of them, and to take advantage, you know, of these peak seasons that we have. Your Easter, which is a peak season. And also when we are hosting, you know, big events like the pilgrimage that is coming. Those people are combat ready. But not only that, if you go to the area next to the two churches of ZCC, the communities around there, we have also spoken to them to make their households available for people to camp and provide them, you know, with ablution and some basic facilities, and those people will be paying. So that is one thing that we are doing, and we have seen it growing because people feel safe, you know, rather than to park on the road. But then if they are able to have a household where they can park their vehicle and also camp there, it's better.
I'm interested in the claim about converting pilgrims into leisure tourists. Is this realistic, or is it just marketing spin from your agency?
Jeremy, it's not marketing spin. It is realistic. What we have done, we have developed strategies. If you go to our website, and that's what we always do, as part of this Easter campaign, the Easter campaign, we have put in, you know, affordable products, and we have put in areas where people can visit. We also put in the events that are happening around, so that people en route to the pilgrimage or after the pilgrimage, you know, they are able to access those areas, you know, very easy. And this we are doing together. Like now, we've got a team at Kranskop that is also handing out pamphlets about those activities that we have put together, so that if people before the pilgrimage or after the pilgrimage, they want to visit, then they can. But the other thing that we are doing is just to raise awareness, to say, as you are going to the pilgrimage, know that just behind the ZCC, within the escarpment, there is so much that people can visit or they can go to. You know, the Fufu slides around Makhubas Kloof, it's not far. It's not even 30 kilometers from the two main churches. So these are the things that we are doing, Jeremy, as part of converting those people to become tourists as well.
What is the financial benefit to the province over the next 4 days?
Look, it's something that we are going to measure as well. Every time after this measure event, we do an analysis. Last year, you know, after the event, and you know that last year we're not fully recovered. This time, both two churches are open. They are bringing big numbers. And last year alone, just for the weekend, we were over 50 million, you know, in trade that we have has been generated out of this. And we are expecting more out of this one.
Moses Ngobeni, thank you very much indeed, and good luck. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Limpopo Tourism Agency.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
This thought leadership interview is brought to you by Discovery Life. Secure your financial future and that of your family with comprehensive financial protection. Learn more at discovery.co.za. Discovery Life, protection as unique as the life it covers. Now, what if your life insurance did more than just protect your family after you're gone? What if it actively rewarded you while you were alive for living well, making smart health choices, taking care of yourself? Well, Discovery Life is doing exactly that. After paying out just over 11.5 billion rand in claims and benefits last year, they're here now to explain how modern insurance is being redesigned or reimagined. And I'm in conversation with the Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Gareth Friedlander, and let's take a look at how clients are cashing in on healthy living. So, Gareth, a very warm welcome. Let's start with that number, 11.5 billion rand. It's a big one. What does it mean for the everyday policyholder?
Yeah, Jeremy, it really is a big number, 11.5 billion. And it's essentially comprised of 6.85 billion in kind of our individual life insurance claims, 2.3 billion under our group risk policies, and then a staggering 2.4 billion in what we call shared value payments. And that's effectively things like cash conversions and paybacks. It's payouts for being healthy to clients. So that's not to claimants themselves. So a really, you know, powerful year with big numbers for our clients and their families.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, you're paying more for living benefits than life cover. So what kind of help then are clients getting while they are still alive and hopefully healthy?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So our life cover claims over the period were 3.4 billion. And then we have other benefits. Life cover is not only death cover. It incorporates a bunch of living benefits like severe illness or disability cover or income protection. So under all of those benefits, we paid a similar amount of 3.4 billion. And then the 2.4 billion that I mentioned to clients just through being healthy. So we paid out more than 60% last year to clients who were either alive under those living benefits or who were actually alive and very healthy through those shared value benefits. And that's really different from what you'll see across the rest of the industry, where typically about 80% of the payouts would be for death claims.
We hear about things like paybacks and cash conversions, but are people, Gareth, really seeing the money come back to them?
Yeah, it's important to understand how that value is generated. It really comes down to the risk component of those clients. And what we saw last year is that our clients who engage in the program, so get themselves to gold or diamond vitality status, actually demonstrated a 57% lower mortality rate and 47% lower disability rate. That means we're paying out fewer claims because our clients are living longer, they're healthier, and that generates money in an insurance context. And we can effectively channel that money back to the clients who created that money in the first place by being healthy. And that's what funds these massive payback benefits. We paid 1.4 billion rand back to clients last year. We've now paid 13.2 billion rand to date through the payback benefit. It's become a flagship benefit of ours. And it's really this kind of physical manifestation of this shared value concept. Get healthier. It creates savings and we pass them back to clients.
If I'm just starting out then on a vitality plan, how long though before I actually see real financial value?
So the answer is very quickly, because the components of the shared value model are spread throughout the duration of your plan. So you can get an upfront discount of up to 48% on your actual life insurance. So the savings manifest from month one. And then each year, as you engage in the program, you get up to 100% of your premiums actually deposited into your payback fund. And then that fund starts to pay out through the duration of your policy. And then we've got longer term benefits, which we call the cash conversion. And that effectively pays out a percentage of your cover while you're still alive in retirement to supplement your retirement savings. So that's a unique way of almost using your healthy living pre-retirement to supplement your post-retirement savings, because now you're going to live a long time, hopefully.
Just put this into perspective now, Gareth, if you can. Cancer, if I read this correctly, continues to dominate the claims landscape. But therein lies some good news, because I imagine that people are catching it a lot more early.
That is right. Cancer is dominant as always, kind of leading cause of death, of disability, and of severe illness across the board. But there is good news. Firstly, we're seeing that cancer is increasingly becoming a behavioral risk. So we're actually it wasn't thought that way many years ago, but we're starting to see that the outcomes and even the kind of incidence of cancer is impacted by your healthy living, by your behavioral and lifestyle choices. And then secondly, the ability to detect it early is absolutely key. We've driven clients through the discovery group through various incentives to go for their screenings. Our mammograms, colorectal cancer screenings, prostate screenings are all up between 14 and 29% and are at all-time highs. And we're starting to see that that is increasing the incidence of early stage cancer claims. Now, it's not that cancer claims incidence are increasing, it's just that people are picking them up. The cancer was there anyway. They just hadn't picked it up. We're starting to pick that up earlier, and that's seen a 62% increase in those early claims. But the good news is that those clients will then have much better survival rates over time, and we're seeing that our stage four cancer incidence is down 16% since last year. So we're starting to see the benefit of that playing out for, you know, survival rates and quality of life thereafter.
So just a final one then, what's the singular most important thing to a person who is thinking about reviewing their life cover over the next 12 months? Where does their head need to be?
That's an interesting question. I think for me, everyone is different. Your circumstances are always different. I would start with advice. The landscape is complex these days in terms of financial services and clients' needs. So I think it's about understanding your circumstances, understanding your gaps in your cover, the risk that you're exposed to. But that all starts with financial advice. And, you know, we're seeing that the insurance gap in South Africa is kind of growing year in and year out. People tend to be underinsured. One little piece that I would give, diversify your cover as well in hard global currency. We've seen the impact of volatility over the last couple of weeks with what's been going on with tariffs, etc. You know, if you don't have dollar cover, for example, the value of your cover that it can buy your loved ones in hard currency can depreciate by 10% overnight. So think about diversifying your risk protection in a kind of hard currency like the US dollar. That would be one that comes to mind.
Gareth Friedlander, thank you very much indeed. Deputy Chief Executive Officer at Discovery Life, and this thought leadership interview brought to you by Discovery Life. Ask your financial advisor for more details or find out more on discovery.co.za. Discovery Life, protection as unique as the life it covers. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are back next week after the Easter break. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.